So Thames Water reckoned that they supplied 2.6 billion litres of water a day into their network, but 24% of that is lost to leaks before it reaches customers.
Hello, I'm Tom Record, and I'm here with Tom Morris. Welcome to Global Infusions, an investment podcast from the Lion Trust Global Fundamental Team that takes a long-term view of today's stories. Last episode, we chatted about sport and how the money flows in this emotive area. This episode, we're talking about water, the stuff that makes up the majority of your body and has defined countries, politics, and conflicts. So if your taste buds are tickled or you have any questions for our next episode, please do send them in via your client contact or through the Contact Us link on the Lion Trust website. So sit back, grab a cup of tea, and remember that when we talk about individual companies, we're not making a recommendation to buy or sell shares, and that some of these companies may not be held across Lion Trust's global fund range. So, Tom, where should we go first? Country borders, droughts, floods, mining, your choice.
Okay, well, let's start 135,000 years ago. So scientists think that a series of mega droughts drove early humans to migrate out of Africa and into the Middle East.
Indeed, to Mesopotamia, which is the Greek for between two rivers.
Is it really? I did not know that. Okay, I'm going to file that away for future use. But the point is that the availability of water has pushed humanity to move and adapt over the course of many thousands of years.
Okay, but I want to go back a little bit further. Have you, Tom, come across the Zanclean mega flood?
Okay, honestly, nothing beyond a kind of vague recollection that it kind of sounds cool and it might have something to do with the Mediterranean, perhaps.
Yeah, well, that's spot on, because it does sound cool. And this was a giant flood 5 and a bit million years ago that literally tore through the Straits of Gibraltar and refilled the Med with water levels rising up to 10 metres a day. Now, there was a giant 1.5 kilometre tall waterfall near Sicily that poured out over the Malta escarpment.
Okay, I'm trying to visualise this, but I am struggling a bit. So the Mediterranean was cut off from the Atlantic as the Strait of Gibraltar closed. It dried up, and then the strait reopened, and then suddenly it got reconnected and reflooded again?
Yep, exactly. And the water rushed in, and it filled the western Mediterranean basin first, and then cascaded into the eastern basin. And it carved this huge canyon, I suppose, that can still be seen today. It's absolutely immense.
Well, that is amazing.
Let's get back to how people are impacted by water. Now, obviously, there are often borders defined by seas or rivers. And in Europe, the River Danube perhaps illustrates this best, passing through four different capital cities. Tom, quiz question for you. Can you name them?
Ah, well, this is an absolutely classic quiz question. So thankfully, I actually do know the answer, which is Vienna, Bratislava, Budapest and Belgrade.
Awesome. Good skills. But it's not just rivers that get entangled with politics. Huge bodies of water can too, like the Aral Sea.
So I've not heard of that.
Well, at one stage, this was the fourth largest lake in the world with a surface of 68,000 square kilometres.
68,000 square kilometres? That's about the same size as Ireland.
Yeah, it was huge. But since then, it's shrunk by more than 90% after the USSR started diverting water for irrigation in the 1960s.
Oh, I think I've seen pictures of like kind of creepy stranded rusting boats in the middle of nowhere. So presumably that was taken in the former Aral Sea.
Yep, that's it. And so you have those sort of boat skeletons that make amazing photos that sort of remind us of the major ecological disaster, I suppose.
Gosh, right. And it's a pattern that we can sadly see happening again and again around the world. I mean, the Great Salt Lake in Utah is shrinking as the snowmelt that historically replenished it is diverted for human use. I think the lake has already shrunk by 2/3 just since the 1980s, and there's a risk that it dries up completely.
And of course, those dry lakes can cause some really big air pollution problems. So the lake bed obviously turns to dust and then can get blown up into the atmosphere.
That's right. Yeah, and it's really a particular... Bad. Yeah. No, it is really bad. It's much worse than I realised. And it's a particular problem for this lake because the lake bed contains high levels of arsenic and it sits right next to Salt Lake City that has over 1 million people living there.
Ooh, nasty.
Yeah, and even before that happens, the shrinking volume of the lake means that the salt concentration keeps rising. So it's currently sort of 12-13%, and if it hits 17%, which is what it's forecast to do over the next couple of years, it will become inhospitable for algae, which are at the bottom of almost all the food chains, and so there's a risk of ecological collapse.
Another sort of eco-disaster. So what can be done about it to prepare for it or to stop it happening?
Really, the only thing they can do is use less water. And there have been some efforts to stop issuing permits for very water-intensive businesses like data centres, for instance.
It's amazing how much water data centers use for cooling, because there's been some discussion recently in the UK about this, because I saw Thames Water were trying to find ways of saving water after the drought that we've had this summer. And they said that one proposed data center in Slough had asked for permission to use, I think it was 25 litres a second, which is about 790 million litres a year, which is about the same as around 5,000 four-person households. And this is just one data centre.
Yes, it is amazing. I would definitely not have guessed they were big water consumers, but they really are. And since you brought up the UK, it makes sense for us to quickly mention the sorry state of water infrastructure in this country.
I mean, some of the stats are absolutely shocking. And the sewage discharges into the sea this year have been horrible. And they even caused a sort of diplomatic spat with France.
So Thames Water reckoned that they supplied 2.6 billion litres of water a day into their network, but 24% of that is lost to leaks before it reaches customers.
So that's over, 600 million litres a day lost to leaks just in the southeast of England?
Yes, and they have the audacity to put hosepipe bans in place. I mean, the one positive I can see is that the regulator is at least forcing them to invest to try and sort this out, with the private owners foregoing dividends for the last few years.
Well, that's something at least, but it's a classic example where the consumer can sort of see the cost, but the product, and I suppose the leaks, are hidden underground.
Mm.
Now might be a good time to move on to the cost of bottled water, which is quite an amazing illustration of sort of human irrationality.
We've got to talk about bottled water.
Okay, so a 500ml bottle of still water in Pret-a-Manger is £1.95. That means the price for a litre is £3.90. Now, even with the UK's famously high fuel taxes, the price of a litre of unleaded petrol is currently about £1.66, so less than half the price.
Yes, and if we just look at the crude oil price, the difference is even bigger. So oil currently trades at about $90 or about £79 a barrel, and there are 159 litres in a standard oil barrel, so that gives a price per litre of about 50p.
So bottled water is massively, massively more expensive than oil. And if you just sort of stop and think for a moment about the difference in technological difficulty between the production of those two liquids. So oil has to be searched for, discovered, and then potential reservoirs studied for years, drilled, developed, working out the dynamics of the reservoir. I mean, they're often beneath kilometres of water and rock and salt, and they require cutting edge of human engineering. It then has to be refined and shipped around the world, I mean, potentially for thousands of miles.
Yes, yes. And mineral water basically just bubbles up to the surface naturally all over the place.
And you compare that to tap water, which, I mean, it can be consumed essentially for free. So Thames Water, they charge 0.15p a litre to metered customers.
So it really does just come down to branding and convenience.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, people are amazingly willing to pay several pounds for something they can get for free at home to save them the hassle of carrying it around with them and to give them the chance to display a brand they like, from Aquapana to Dasani.
Yes, and it is worth noting that Dasani is literally just filtered tap water. It's not even mineral water.
Indeed, yeah. And on that note, it's nice to see more and more places offering free filtered water taps. So from train stations to cafes, all over the place.
Yes, exactly. I see them at Waterloo now every day. And, you know, it's a really good thing. Right, so we should talk a bit about the use of water in food, I think, as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's pretty common knowledge now that beef is extremely water intensive. I mean, The Guardian reckons that that for every 1 kilogram of beef, you need about 15,000 litres of water to produce it, about 98% of which is used to grow the crops that the cow eats.
Now, that's a pretty shocking stat.
It is. But what is talked about less often is the context. So a household of four people in the UK uses about 160,000 litres a year. So that 1 kilogram of beef is equivalent to almost 10% of their annual water usage.
Well, so when we talk about the water use of a family as just being the amount that comes out of their taps at home, we're really sort of kidding ourselves.
Yes, yeah. Food is an absolutely enormous part of our consumption. It's just harder to see, and so people don't really measure it as much.
Okay, and it's not just beef. Lamb and pork also have a lot of embedded water, at over 10,000 and 5,000 litres per kilogram. And of course, dairy does too, as a consequence of the cows.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So vegetables are obviously the least impactful. A kilo of potatoes takes about 290 litres of water to produce. Chicken is the lowest impact meat I could find, but it's still about 4,000 litres a kilogram.
Yeah, and of course, the materials and clothing embed quite a lot of water too. So cotton, for instance, requires about 10,000 litres of water per kilogram. It's as bad as sheep.
Well, jeans have got a lot to answer for, not just from a fashion perspective, but you know, we haven't even got time this episode to discuss the energy and the chemicals used in the dyeing and artificial weathering processes.
Yeah, let's leave that for another episode, Tom. Okay, so let's get back into politics. And the other day, I was reading a paper about the importance of water in shaping imperial China.
Okay, so this is presumably going back a long time, you know, to 2,000 years or so.
Yeah, exactly. And the peculiarities of China's geography, and particularly her waterways, meant that any group that sort of aspired to unify China had to carry out large-scale water management activities through a centralized state to stop floods and to maintain the navigable rivers.
Oh, okay. So water has historically pushed China into becoming a more integrated political entity. And that's played out for thousands of years, I guess. And therefore, it must have had a huge influence on the culture and creating a sort of collective psyche.
Yeah, exactly. And there are also challenges when rivers span multiple countries. So if we stay with sort of China and the southeast of Asia, the major rivers such as the Mekong have been a cause of concern in recent years.
Ah, yes. So China's been building dams on the Mekong, I think, hasn't it? And that's changed the flow of the river in countries further downstream that rely on it as a, you know, a big part of their economy, a big part of people's livelihoods.
Yeah. And in 2018, so it got to an extreme when the Mekong's water level fell to its lowest level in 100 years. And that was during the monsoon time.
Gosh.
China's built this sort of huge degree of leverage over its downstream neighbours like Laos, Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia and Vietnam.
So there is a UN convention, I think, on water courses dating back to 1997, but it doesn't seem to have much in the way of teeth.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably another one that we could have included in our episode on bad rules the other day.
Yeah. Okay, so before we finish on water, I just wanted to mention the floods in Pakistan, which have been pretty extreme.
Yeah, it looks like about a third of the country has been affected. And, well, Pakistan is not a small place.
Yeah, it's terrible. And it has almost certainly been made worse by climate change.
Yeah, another example of a poorer country bearing the worst of the consequences whilst emitting very little CO2.
Yes, yeah. Personally, I think it just shows why richer countries ought to be sending more money to poorer ones to help them adapt to more extreme weather and to move away from things like coal power generation.
Agreed. So let's move on to the news. Tom, what do you have for us this episode?
Okay, well, the first thing that caught my eye this month was Stable Diffusion, another image generation AI similar to DALL-E, but that we spoke about on the podcast a couple of months ago, but with a big difference that it's open source.
Ah, I see. And I must say that it was a lot of fun playing around with the keywords for DALL-E after we got accepted onto the early user program.
Yes, yeah, it was really impressive and also, frankly, hilarious. So my favourite one that we did was when we asked for a painting of a hedge fund manager making a splash in the style of David Hockney, which actually worked really, really well.
Yeah, it was a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So Tom, sorry, you're saying about Stable Diffusion.
Yeah. So while most of these headline-grabbing AIs are locked down by their creators, Stable Diffusion is available for anybody to play with, even for commercial use. You can host it in the cloud, you can run it on your computer at home, you can even start making programs that sit on top of it.
Yeah, I saw that someone's already made a plugin for Photoshop that allows people to generate AI art with a few clicks when they're working on a project.
Yes. And one of the initial killer use cases has to be a plugin for Microsoft Office to give a sort of modern alternative to Clipart.
Yeah, it feels like a really exciting time for image AI. We're seeing remarkable innovation almost every month.
We're certainly all going to have to become a lot more skeptical about supposed photographic evidence.
Indeed. Okay, so the first thing from me today is also an AI and a paper from Google about AI smell.
Smell.
Yes. Yeah. Odors. So Google has developed an AI that can fairly accurately predict how things will smell based on their molecular structure. So this is something that previously was extremely difficult.
Oh, fascinating.
Well, it works by creating an odor map that places different smells and sort of different areas on that map. And it looks really quite cool. And the idea was sort of based on a color map that shows saturation and hue.
Okay, and then what? So they use this map to train the AI, and then they're now seeing if the AI can predict smells.
Exactly. Yeah. And Tom, it was really, really good at predicting.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like a bit of sort of fun science, but did it come up with any sort of useful applications, useful results?
Well, there was one example that really gripped me, and that is that they've been searching for new molecules that repel mosquitoes more effectively than DEET and are more stable, cheaper and less sort of harmful to produce.
Oh, well, that really is an important cause. Okay, so hopefully they will make some progress then, because, you know, DEET's a pretty nasty chemical. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next thing from me is on energy.
Which is a huge issue at the moment.
Indeed. So there have been headlines across Europe recently as national governments announced packages of support for consumers and businesses to help them deal with exceptionally high energy prices caused by the war in Ukraine.
So this is from Russia restricting natural gas flows into continental Europe.
Yes, which has pushed both gas and electricity prices to levels many times higher than previous records.
Yeah, and I think the electricity situation has been made even worse by coincident outages in many of France's nuclear power station as sort of corroded pipes are replaced. It's just, yeah, poor timing.
Yeah, it's very, very poor timing, but at least it's being dealt with safely. So, you know, no safety issues there. But what I really wanted to highlight is the scale of these support programmes. So the UK package announced by our new PM, Liz Truss, is estimated to cost about £150 billion.
Which I think is about 7% or so of GDP.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't tell the whole story, really. I mean, when it's presented as 7% of GDP, it doesn't sound that bad. 7 isn't a big number, I think. And most people, when they're flicking through their newspaper, probably just think, fair enough, and they move on. But 7% of GDP, £150 billion, is an absolutely enormous number. It's the same as the budget for the whole NHS in 2019.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. It's way more than we spend on education and defence combined, which would be about £110 billion.
Okay, Tom, this is starting to sound like a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same as all the money that is raised from capital gains taxes, council taxes, fuel duty, tobacco and alcohol duties and business rates combined, which were about £152 billion last year.
Okay, I get it.
good, right. Now, I also had a look at how much renewable generation capacity could be added in the UK if we'd planned ahead and spent that £150 billion on wind turbines instead. So based on the cost of the Dogger Bank offshore wind farm, which is about £9 billion for 3.6 gigawatts of capacity, I reckon £150 billion would pay for about 60 gigawatts of wind turbines.
Okay, so to put that in context, can you remind me what UK electricity demand is?
30 gigawatts.
Oh.
Yes, oh, exactly. And I know the wind doesn't blow all the time, et cetera, so I looked at existing wind capacity, which is about 25 gigawatts, and I compared that to the average wind energy production over the last year, which was just under 7 gigawatts, so about 30% or so of the nameplate capacity. And on that basis, an extra 60 gigawatts of capacity could be expected to add about 18 gigawatts of power on average, which would make a huge difference to the UK.
Agreed. Right. So the second thing I wanted to highlight this episode is a really interesting post from NASA.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It seems like we've seen a lot of amazing stuff from them recently since the launch of that amazing James Webb telescope.
Yeah, we have. But this one isn't an image. It's a sound.
I thought space was silent.
Well, yeah, you're right, the vacuum of space is, but a galaxy cluster has enough gas that sound waves can propagate through it for extremely long distances.
Okay, so in space, no one can hear you scream unless you're in a galaxy cluster. So what have they found? What have they found?
Well, they found that pressure waves created by the black hole at the center of the Perseus galaxy cluster are causing ripples in that cluster's hot gas that could be interpreted as a note. And those ripples were picked up by NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. But there is one problem.
Oh, yes. Okay. What's the problem?
The note is about 57 octaves below middle C, so far too deep for human ears to perceive.
Okay. So 57 is a lot of octaves. So this is a ridiculously deep sound.
Yeah. Yeah. And so NASA have very kindly scaled the sound up into the range of our hearing and put it on YouTube. And so you can hear the sounds of a kind of a creepy cosmic whale song.
Oh, well, that is cool. I mean, it's just a shame that Douglas Adams isn't around anymore to interpret this for us. okay, right. So the final thing from me this month is a bit of a follow-up on last episode's discussion on sport. So Serena Williams retired from competitive tennis in September after winning 23 singles Grand Slams, the most of any human being in the Open era. I thought it might be interesting to have a quick look at her career earnings as one of the greatest sports people of all time.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with the prize money.
Okay, so Serena tops the all-time WTA career prize money ranking by a long way, with about $95 million, more than double the haul from the number two, her sister Venus Williams.
That's quite a family record.
Yeah, it is. I thought the same thing. Okay, so as we discussed last week, there are no wages in tennis. And so it's notable that the rest of Serena's earnings About $350 million, according to Sportico, came from endorsements. She's also had some success in venture capital investment, which is becoming a bigger area of interest for celebrities, as we discussed back on our episode about fame.
Yeah, very good. So the last thing from me this episode is a story, a rather sad story, about a Japanese man who married a virtual character.
Oh yes, I remember reading about this a few years ago. I think he'd taken his fanhood to the next level by holding a marriage ceremony with a kind of virtual singer.
Yep, that's right, Tom. She was called Hatsune Miku, and the man, Akihito Kondo, married a hologram of her displayed inside a gadget called a gate box, which is basically a glass tube about the size of a coffee machine that allowed him to interact with her.
Ah, I think I saw a YouTube video demoing the gate box. It was quite a cool holographic display. It sort of makes it look like you have a tiny cartoon character in a glass bottle, a bit like Tinkerbell in Peter Pan. And there's some basic AI that allows you to have a bit of a conversation and set reminders and use other features similar to Siri or Alexa or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. It was quite cool. It's like having a little genie in a bottle. But the problem is that the makers of Gatebox are now discontinuing the service so that Kondo will no longer be able to interact with his virtual wife.
Well, that is actually quite sad.
It is. And it shows that while virtual characters may not die because they were never alive, they can still become obsolete or get hacked or just break, which really isn't that different to getting ill or dying.
No, that's a good point. I mean, just being virtual doesn't suddenly tidy up all the messy bits of real life.
Well, thank you for listening to Global Infusions, a podcast that believes that the best discussions are had over tea and cake. We hope you've enjoyed your cuppa and our thoughts on water. Please do subscribe through Apple or Spotify. And with that, we wish you goodbye.
Goodbye.